From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Cap Radio will carry tomorrow night's State of the Union speech by President Trump. It starts at 6 p.m. here in the West. Virginia's governor, meanwhile, is being asked to resign in the midst of a controversy there. So the political headlines might have been a bit overshadowed by a very big football game last night, or as in the case across California and Nevada, some weather. We've had big rain and snowstorms, even tornado warnings. So let's get you caught up in my weekly conversation with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. He joins us from the Washington, D.C. area. Hello, Ken. Late night for everybody in the East with that football game.
Well, yes, but I would say that the situation involving Governor Northam of Virginia is far more interesting than last night's Super Bowl.
So this had become a news item before the game. He held a press conference over the weekend, and I think it's fair to say the situation is still volatile at this moment. He is still in his job. So will you expand the background on what's happening?
Well, yeah, he's still in his job as for now. I don't think he'll be in his job for long, given the fact that, and forget about what Republicans have to say. I mean, Republicans are saying that they have to that he has to resign. But Republicans also supported Corey Stewart, who's a Confederacy supporter for the Senate last year. So I kind of dismiss what Republicans have to say in Virginia. But the fact is that Democrats in Virginia, Tim Kaine, Mark Warner, the two senators, Terry McAuliffe, the former governor, all say Northam should resign, as has Julian Castro and Kamala Harris, two presidential candidates. So I think it's just a matter of time. And basically what it is that there was a photograph on Northam's college yearbook page from 1984 that showed a picture of him. Then it showed a picture of two people side by side. One person was in blackface. One was dressed up as a Ku Klux Klan member. And at first, and what made it even worse was that Northam said, well, I don't know if that's me or not. It reminds me of Donald Trump in the Access Hollywood tape. I don't know if that was my voice or not. I mean, you know it or you don't know it. You don't,
well,
I don't
he
know
initially,
how you not know it.
He initially apologized and said,
well, yeah, he apologized. And then the last line is, no, that wasn't me at all. But I did do kind of blackface when I did Michael Jackson.
In a talent contest.
At some party or something. But anyway, the fact is he did this in 1984, not 1884. I don't know anybody who thinks blackface was acceptable or even funny in 1984. And while, look, does he have a progressive record? Yes. But in this day and age of given the fact that the Democrats want to make sure they're nothing like the Republican Party, a party that you know, where your president had nice things to say about Charlottesville, nice things to say about Steve King, the kind of racist congressman from Iowa, and of course, Corey Stewart, the Confederacy senator, the guy who ran for the Senate in Virginia last year. The Democrats don't want to be anything like that. And just like they threw Al Franken under the bus early because of the Me Too movement, I think the feeling is the same thing with Ralph Northam, that it's just not good for the party. And while we hate to sacrifice a politician who has a bright future, it's more important for the state and the party that it's time for him to go.
2 points I want to touch on this. A USA Today article, Ken, says that Virginia's Constitution says elected officials who commit, quote, malfeasance in office, corruption, neglect of duty, or other high crime or misdemeanor can be removed from office. And there's some thought that what this allegation is about the yearbook doesn't fall under those specific descriptions, that criteria.
Agree. And that's why they're not going to remove him. He has to resign on his own.
Okay, then let me move to the next point, and that is a lot of attention is being paid to the lieutenant governor, Justin Fairfax, an article in the New York Times about him. Fox News has jumped out with details about his past, including a denial to a long-ago allegation of sexual assault. So there's a lot surrounding who might step into the office as well.
Yeah, that Fairfax thing, the Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, who is African-American, by the way, that is a very important. He's one of the very few people, one of the very few Democrats. Barack Obama is another one who who has not called for Northam to resign. But that new thing about Fairfax does complicate the story. But again, when you lose the confidence of both U.S. senators, members of Congress from Virginia, Democrats, Terry McAuliffe, who may be running for president, and Kamala Harris and Julian Castro, two people of color who are running for president, I just don't see how, for better or worse, I mean, I understand that people say that it was just a horrific thing, that it's not a childhood thing, that in 1984 you should know the difference. I think it's complicated, but I just don't see how he lands. I'm not advocating his resignation, but I don't know how he stays on. I just don't.
Let me read the first line of the New York Times article about the lieutenant governor, because my bigger question is, what about his political future in a broader sense? The first line reads, when he was sworn in last year as Virginia's lieutenant governor, Justin Fairfax kept in his pocket the document that freed his great-great-great-grandfather from slavery. So his story is powerful across the country. What do you know about him as an elected official, as a person?
You know something? Surprisingly little. I mean, the fact about the sexual harassment, whatever it was, the allegations are brand new to me. Basically, I mean, look, there were three separately constitutionally elected officials in Virginia: governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general, all elected separately, not together on a ticket. And we didn't really pay much attention to Justin Fairfax because, you know, everything was about the governor's race and the fact that once upon a time, Virginia, which was a long time a red state, then had become purple because Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton won the state, carried the state in the last three elections. And now you think that under Northam and Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, the state is becoming more and more blue. And given the fact that there are state legislative elections this fall, both the House of Delegates and the state Senate are completely up for election, you know that you wonder if Northam has lost his way. And I don't know, again, what the future of Fairfax is, but the Democrats are desperate to make more gains. And they may not be able to do that if they're on the defensive over its governor and perhaps lieutenant governor as well.
One more note here from the Fox News report, Ken. It says that this allegation of sexual assault that goes back 15 years toward the lieutenant governor was posted by a group called Big League Politics. And apparently this was the same political blog that published the yearbook photo involving Governor Northam. So Big League Politics is that group, although I am not sure either much about the group, and I'm not sure whether they are saying any more, whether there's been any press release about that.
Well, let me tell you, what I know about Big League Politics is that it is a conservative group. It has ties to Breitbart and other conservatives like that. But that's not the point. I mean, whatever you think of Breitbart and the conservatives who may be behind it, the fact is, if Ralph Northam did appear in blackface, if there are credible sexual harassment allegations of Justin Fairfax, the lieutenant governor, then it doesn't matter who came up with it. I mean, as long if these are legitimate complaints, legitimate allegations, then these are serious things. It doesn't matter if it's a left wing, right wing, or no wing group that's responsible for it. It's really it's incumbent on the members of, you know, the governor and the lieutenant governor to adequately explain what happened, and if not, their political future could be very well limited.
You know, Ken, I was thinking about whether to bring that point up or not. And what you say, I absolutely agree with. But lest somebody think that the yearbook photo was exposed in an effort to make sure that the lieutenant governor had a shot at moving up into the governor's office, I thought that it was worth noting that both allegations, both situations of controversy right now, came out of the same group.
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody cares. I don't think this group is trying to get Justin Fairfax governor. I think they want to embarrass the governor. But look, same with the photo of apparently Al Franken groping up. Look. Robert Byrd, The late senator from West Virginia was a longtime member of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1930s and 1940s. The fact is he rose to become Senate Majority Leader. Would Robert Byrd be able to have that position today? I hardly think so. And so when you uncover a picture of Al Franken groping a woman for fun or not, you know, thinking it's a joke or not, the fact is, maybe that was laughed at or ignored or eyes rolled at years ago. That is not acceptable anymore. We learned that with the Me Too movement and all those kind of groups. So yes, Donald Trump, you know, for all his comments about when he was in the Access Hollywood tape, and yes, his comments about Charlottesville, and yes, his defense of Steve King, the Iowa congressman, for so long. The point is the Democratic Party is insisting that we are not like them. We are not like the Republicans. And if we have to eat our own, which is basically what they did with Al Franken and perhaps Ralph Northam as well, so be it, because we want to show that we're different from the Republican Party and President Trump.
You're listening to Ken Rudin, the political junkie. This is our weekly conversation. And because you mentioned the president, let's jump to the interview with CBS News that aired in the Super Bowl context of the broadcast last night.
Being in Iraq was a mistake. Okay, being in Iraq, it was a big mistake to go. One of the greatest mistakes going into the Middle East that our country has ever made. One of the greatest mistakes that we've ever made.
But you want to keep troops there now.
When it was chosen, well, we spent a fortune on building this incredible base. We might as well keep it. And one of the reasons I want to keep it is because I want to be looking a little bit at Iran, because Iran is a real problem.
Whoa, that's news. You're keeping troops in Iraq because you want to be able to strike in Iran?
No, because I want to be able to watch Iran. All I want to do is be able to watch.
Journalist Margaret Brennan conducted the interview. That was a big exchange, a big statement there, Ken. What did it say to you?
Well, it said to me that I think history will prove the president correct on that sense, in the sense that Iraq was a mistake. Now, there's some question whether Donald Trump really opposed the war from the beginning, as he says he did. That's not the issue. Iraq was a mistake. Afghanistan was a mistake. And for all the people saying, well, pulling out could endanger security, it could open up Iraq to Iranian expansion. Well, I think Iraq is already open to Iranian expansion now that you have the Shiites in power in Iraq and now no longer the Sunnis. So I kind of think that is done. And whether you pull out of Syria, I mean, what have we accomplished? What have we accomplished in all these years in Afghanistan and Iraq? Americans are still getting killed. There's still no, you know, I don't know what we tried to accomplish there, but it doesn't seem to be working. So I know Margaret Brennan asked the obvious question, well, does it give us an opportunity to strike at Iran? Let's hope that striking Iran is not the answer, just like the president said over the weekend that sending in troops to Venezuela might be an option. My goodness, I mean, haven't we learned already that stop sending troops to these countries that only is just going to backfire on us? But the point is, I think the American people are tired of Iraq. They are tired of Afghanistan. They are tired of Americans getting killed. And you know, I mean, it sounds like in many ways he is like the Tulsi Gabbards or the Elizabeth Warrens or the Bernie Sanders of the world, saying that U.S. troops do not belong in these countries.
I want to play one more clip in this realm of foreign policy, because this gets to specifically the information that the president receives and how he handles that information. And again, you're going to hear the voice of CBS News correspondent and host Margaret Brennan.
I want to move on here, but I should say your intel chiefs do say Iran's abiding by that nuclear deal. I know you think it's a bad deal.
I disagree with them. I'm, by the way,
you disagree with that assessment.
I have intel people. That doesn't mean I have to agree. President Bush had intel people that said Saddam Hussein in Iraq had nuclear weapons, had all sorts of weapons of mass destruction. Guess what? Those intel people didn't know what the hell they were doing. And they got us tied up in a war that we should have never been in. And we've spent $7 trillion in the Middle East.
Ken, I think he's going to sound more of that, take more of that line in the speech tomorrow night, don't you?
Well, he's been saying that all along. The fact is, look, did the U.S. have faulty intelligence evidence regarding Iraq and about weapons of mass destruction, I think everybody acknowledges that. Bush, Cheney, well, maybe Cheney may not acknowledge it, but Colin Powell certainly does. But when Trump says, I don't believe the intelligence agencies, he's been saying that ever since they said that Russia was definitely involved in trying to sway the 2016 election, that Russia was definitely involved. And of course, as if you're President Trump, you do everything you can not to criticize Russia. And so therefore, I mean, we saw this in Helsinki. Who do you believe, Vladimir Putin or the intelligence agencies? And Trump made it clear in Helsinki that he believed Putin because Putin said, well, I didn't do it. So therefore, forget about what intelligence agencies say. And that's the scary part about all this. When you have a president of the United States who says he doesn't need intelligence briefings because he knows more than the intelligence people, if he says he knows more than what the generals know, well, I don't know any president in history has ever said that. And it is cause for concern, but this is Donald Trump. This has been Donald Trump before he was president. He believes his own instinct. He's the smartest guy in the room. And if you're part of the intelligence community, well, too bad, because you don't know as much as I do. And that is very unfortunate.
Ken, how influential do you think, or interesting, I guess pick a word if you don't like those two, these presidential interviews as part of the Super Bowl celebration and entertainment are? They're fairly recent in terms of American politics.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember. I mean, I'm trying to think back. I don't remember any Super Bowl interview with a president before George W. Bush. And to be honest with you, I didn't watch the interview until after the game. I mean, all I cared about was the game and and whether the New England Patriots and their weapons of mass destruction could be stopped. And of course, they never get stopped. So, I mean, they're not my favorite team, but they are an amazing team. So I didn't watch the interviews until afterwards. But sometimes, even though the president does have his usual talking points, you do learn some things about him. I thought his talk about whether his son Barron should ever play football, and he said I would have recommended against it because of the violence and the injuries to the head. I mean, sometimes he can get introspective, but when he starts talking about Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats and all the people who's on his enemies list, it becomes very tiresome. And I would think you're going to see a lot of that tomorrow during the State of the Union address.
You're listening to Ken Rudin, the political junkie. The State of the Union address will be carried live on CAP Radio. It begins at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. here in the West. So the president is tweeting this morning about immigration. I guess in the extreme sense, you could wonder if he would declare a national emergency in the context of that speech. At the very least, he's going to address his ongoing firm position that could in the next, 10 days, 2 weeks, lead to another government shutdown?
Right. February 15th is the deadline. And I suspect that what we're going to hear tomorrow night is very similar to what the president has said the last two times he had things to say to the American people. And that is that the Democrats don't have no interest in negotiating. They have no interest in protecting our borders, and therefore an option is either a shutdown or it is using his emergency powers. The fact is that unlike what we've seen in the past, the Republican Party is not completely behind the president on this use of emergency powers. Remember when Trump was running for president in 2015 and 2016, he would talk endlessly about how many times Barack Obama used executive orders and these secret powers to his advantage. And Trump was against that, but of course he hasn't ruled out doing that for himself. It'll also be very interesting. Sometimes the response to the State of the Union is dreadful. We saw that with Marco Rubio, the famous time when he had to go drink for reach for a bottle of water. When Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, did his response to the State of the Union, it was very, very awkward and corny. When Tim Kaine did his response, all I could stare at was his eyebrows. Meanwhile, so anyway, tomorrow is Stacey Abrams, African-American woman, the defeated candidate for governor of Georgia last year. And She is talking about running for the Senate. She is one of the Democrats' favorite new faces. It'll be very interesting to see the contrast between the president and what Stacey Abrams has to say.
She was quoted as saying that she's terrified, not because she might make a mistake, but because so many want the opportunity to rebut what they've seen over the past few years. She feels a lot of weight and pressure and expectation.
There is weight on her shoulders, and you know that what if she, you know, makes crosses her eyes or something, or stammers once, will be all over her. That's the nature of the media when it comes to this kind of rebuttal to the State of the Union. But it'll be certainly, I think, there'll be a lot of interest in what she has to say and how she says it.
And the Spanish language response will be given by California's Attorney General Javier Becerra. All right, Ken. Well, we covered a lot of ground. It's the beginning of a big week, and a lot's going to change before next week. So I'll look forward to our chat then.
Beth, a lot will change by tomorrow, but we'll have to wait till next Monday. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ken. He is Ken Rudin, the political junkie. You can find more at capradio.org. And again, that speech will be carried live tomorrow night at 6 p.m. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.